One of our guests on the show today, Dr. LaShawn Williams at Utah Valley University, told us she's waiting to see when this window of opportunity that's opened up in the wake of the killing of George Floyd will close back up. And as you'll hear later, it's not an expression of cynicism. But if you're black in this country, you'd be forgiven for thinking this moment will pass like it always has before. But the wave of protests in Salt Lake City and other places in Utah doesn't seem to be subsiding right now. It really does feel like momentum. You could see it in Salt Lake City Council meetings recently, where members listened to hours of public comment. KUER's John Reed was covering the story.
Council members have been flooded with comments over the last couple of weeks calling for massive reform. They want to see the police department defunded. And that's kind of followed in response to the death of George Floyd in police custody, as well as a recent killing here in Salt Lake of a young man, Bernardo Palacios.
As a woman of color who has personally experienced poverty and homelessness, I consistently witness how unjust the SLCPD is. I am disgusted and appalled by what happened to Bernardo Palacios Carvajal. That could have been my brother, my cousin.
So people are calling into these council meetings, and there's a lot of frustration. There's a lot of anger that's coming through their comments.
I want you council members to ask yourself if you want to be known as the men and women who fund the paychecks and pensions of people who murder minority groups, push elderly men down the streets, and drive a proverbial knee into the necks of peaceful protesters.
And they're asking, demanding often, that action is taken with the police department, because people here are just kind of unconvinced that police departments have people's best interests at heart.
I have never felt safe around the police department in our city.
The police department in Salt Lake City murder black people. It runs so deep.
This is systematic racism and needs to change. The police must be abolished. Defund the police completely.
Council members in general seem pretty receptive to at least being open to considering how this might be done. I spoke to council member Amy Fowler recently. I mean, she, I think, as well as all of them, are just kind of in a listening phase right now.
At the end of the day, it may not look exactly how people want it to look. We're listening and we're trying to come up with solutions, and that this is something that's not just going to change overnight, that I'm willing to not just give it lip service today and forget about it tomorrow.
No one really has answers as to how this is going to look or when exactly this will happen. Probably something that's going to take years and will probably take a lot of experimentation to get right.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what it would mean to defund the police in Salt Lake City. And we'll begin with the mayor. Salt Lake City Mayor Erin Mendenhall, and what she was hearing in those hours and hours of public comments.
In the public hearings, there's a very focused request to remove $30 million from Salt Lake City's police department. There hasn't been, amid all of that, a very clear breakdown of how that $30 million number was arrived at. But it's more than a third of our city's police department budget, which is at about $84 million this year. Mm. That budget is the flattest police budget that we've had since I've been out in office in City Hall for the last 7 years. And yet there's a request to defund it or remove about a third of the funding. We look at other cities like Los Angeles, who's looking at about a 6-7% reduction of their police budget. But the defunding at the tune of $30 million is squarely in the council's hands at this point. And I'm not hearing them say in their public meetings or in any of the forums that I listen to them that that's something they're contemplating.
Is $30 million too much from your perspective?
$30 million would absolutely mean layoffs, which I think is obvious and the intention of people who are making that request. And I think that for me, that it's important that we do community policing, not reactive policing, which is something that Chief Burbank the model that was operating under Chief Burbank was less focused on community policing. And since Chief Brown has been in that role, we've put a focus on getting officers out to build relationships with the community and have more of a beat patrol presence. And that's the direction that our police department has gone because of that. It would mean a dramatic decrease in the number of officers and therefore a shift away from community-based policing.
That's too much. You're saying it's too much.
I do think it's too much at this point in the conversation.
Right. So here's the growth trajectory of the Salt Lake City Police Department's budget over the last few years, and I wanted to get your take on it. 2017, $63 million. 2018, $65 million. 2019, it was $70 million. And then from 19 to 20, there's this big jump from $70 million to $82 million or something like that. And I wanted to get your sense, is that growth pattern about right to you? I mean, that jump from 2019 to 2020 was an increase of nearly 16%. That's way far ahead of cost of living increases. Is that justified?
Well, there's an important detail in there that I don't know if you're aware of, which is that the majority of that increase came from the transfer of the airport, which was existing outside of the Salt Lake City Police Department. These are airport police officers to the Salt Lake City Police Department budget, which was nearly $8 million. Same amount of officers at the airport, but now they function under one management instead of two. That was the majority of that increase. The other piece of it was that over the course of two budgets, the city council, when I was on the council, in wanting to do more community-based policing and less reactive policing, increased the number of patrol officers by 50. And all of the increased officer funding came from the Funding Our Future conversation, which was a sales tax increase conversation we had as a community back in 2018. And so that was new revenue that was created. We asked the city, our residents, what would you like to see more of? And four things came through loud and clear: better streets, more public transit, more affordable housing, and more police presence in the community. Now that's very different from the conversation that we're hearing at public hearings today. But that was a dialogue that we had just 2 years ago as a city community.
You're hearing more and more of this argument that policing is a tool of violence. It's been used historically in this country to facilitate inequalities and exploitation. What do you make of that sentiment? Do you agree with any part of that sentiment?
I would say that racism is a part of every system in our nation, and that some of these systems were explicitly built to create opportunities or protections for white people and not for others. Now, over the years, what was explicit has become implicit for much of the national dialogue and for many of the elected people throughout the country, but not all. But we see that intrinsic nature of oppression in all of our systems, including in policing. And that's something that we need to be honest about as a country and as elected officials. People have avoided this conversation for the most part, at least to the degree that we're having it today as a nation, for 400 years. 400 years of oppression and racism throughout policing, throughout housing, zoning, finance, access to education, access to fresh food. I mean, you name it, the judicial system. Every piece of our systems needs to be unpacked and rebuilt by working with people who have been oppressed so far.
So therefore, do you think it's time for a rethink about the way not only the police department is funded, but the techniques? I mean, for example, do you agree with the sentiment that police departments generally in urban areas in particular have become too militarized, that the focus is on tactics and gear more in line with, you know, wars and conflict than in keeping the peace in a community?
Yeah, you know, I think I would agree with the sentiment that particularly since 9/11, that there has been federally supported efforts to create more of a militarized police presence in the United States. But I also think that the idea of defunding police departments to the extent that they don't have the funding for training, they don't have the funding for community-based policing and relationship building is not going to help us in the long run. We look at areas around the country like Camden, where they have undone their police department. That I think the headline doesn't also iterate that they rebuilt the police department. They still have police officers, but it was so intrinsically flawed that they had to, you know, throw that baby out with the bathwater. I don't believe that our police department is in that state. Does it mean that I agree with everything Chief Brown says? Not necessarily. But I do think that we have a police department, we have a chief who wants to do what is right, and he's open to the change that needs to happen. I think he's very capable of being the leader that we need him to be to create the changes that we need to see in our police department.
Have you seen evidence of systemic racism within the Salt Lake City Police Department? And I'm wondering, where does the shooting last month of Bernardo Palacios Carbajal fit in the larger picture here?
I think it's very worthwhile to look at the statistics, which I apologize, I don't have those in front of me right now. And when we look at the race or ethnicity of people who have interactions with the police to whatever degree, we see that this is not a reflection of the demographics of our city or our statewide community, that people of color end up in that interaction, whether it become an officer-involved critical incident or it's simply a traffic stop, that we see those interactions at a higher degree with people of color. That right there should say two things to us as a community. Why are the officers engaging in that? You know, what was the behavior or what was the implicit bias in their own thinking that led to that engagement? But secondly, the reality that this isn't unique to Salt Lake City, this happens across our country. And to a large degree, we need to unpack all of those systems that end up disenfranchising and taking away opportunities from people so that they end up in areas of higher crime. They end up with less access to jobs, end up with less access to training and education, to childcare, and all of the other components that allow people to be successful and thrive. And it simply isn't equitable right now.
Does Chief Brown have your complete support and confidence at this point?
I will say that I don't agree with everything that Chief Brown has said, but he does have my confidence that he is the leader of that police department who both can enact the change within the department and that his heart is in the right place in terms of wanting to make the change, wanting to listen. And we've seen that, I think, over the years, that he's made it a priority to create relationships where Salt Lake City Police Department did not have any, from mosques and synagogues and churches to school groups and the community action group that comes together over the last 3 years on a regular basis, includes Black Lives Matter, Utahns Against Police Brutality, and many other organizations, and frankly, families of individuals who have been involved in those officer-involved critical incidents. Mm-hmm. So it's a conversation he's built with intention, and I know that he welcomes, even though it's his officers that are, you know, under the microscope, this is where we need to be. This is what has to happen right now. And I think he welcomes it.
Let me ask you finally, what do you do now in this sense? What do you do now that might be different than what has been done in the past? How do you embrace what seems like this window of opportunity to make significant change? Because it seems like that is one thing that you're hearing. Like, people are saying, let's take a moment to really embrace this and do actual something that's different that may represent change. How are you thinking about that?
Let me say at the outright that, again, it's about us listening and it's about us sitting with the vulnerability that we may feel as people of privilege and people in power to be willing to unpack and listen and learn and reevaluate the lens through which we've seen everything. So in that vein, there's a lot of short-term things we can do. We can strengthen our civilian review board. We have some vacant positions. We also need to be increasing the diversity on that board. We're putting together a commission to review our policing policies. As I mentioned, they will be making recommendations to the council for legal changes and to my administration for administrative opportunities. We need to emphasize building more trust with the community. And I mentioned Chief Brown has made that a priority of his, but I want to see our officers making better inroads into these relationships with the community. But this co-responder model is another one that we could look at growing. That's where we have social workers that go out with our police officers. And we need to be looking at the tools we have, the tools we don't have, the policies that we have, the policies we don't have, And it's really a 24/7 effort for us as a city. We need to do this work. We need everyone behind it. And we need our vulnerable hearts willing to hear the hard things about the ways that we haven't done it yet. And why didn't we do it before? That's all part of this conversation, too. And I'm open to it.
Mayor Mendenhall, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall. Amy Fowler is on the Salt Lake City Council, and we began our conversation with her with the same question I put to the mayor. When she hears activists calling to defund the police, what is she hearing?
What I heard is outrage and sadness and a desire for change, calling on us, the elected officials, to really dig in and do something meaningful to make change.
So when you hear the word defund or dismantle, and some people do literally mean it, but it also seems like it's a sort of symbolic words to express, let's rethink this. Let's find reform that's different. Do you think that's right?
I think that is right. I've been thinking about this and, in fact, had a really interesting conversation with a police officer friend of mine yesterday. And as we were really digging in and talking about this, I realized that when I say reallocate funds, maybe what we're talking about is reallocating tasks. Do we need a police officer to show up at an encampment? Maybe there's nothing illegal happening other than there's camping in a park, or do we need a social services team to show up there? And I don't know the answer, but I think exploring some of those options is what we need to be doing.
For several years now, the funding for the police department has been on this upward trend. It's been growing. And in some ways, a lot more than the rate of the cost of living. And I'm wondering if you think that's right. For example, the rate increase from 2018 to 2019 was almost 8%. There are some extenuating circumstances that made the 2019 to 2020 increase something like nearly 16%. But still, that's a lot of growth. Do the conditions on the ground justify an increase like that and this growing trend, do you think?
I don't know. What my goal is to look at that. And I think going back to, are we funding the right things? Meaning, do we need to look at reallocating tasks and reallocating funding for what the needs of Salt Lake City residents really are?
But you've got to make a decision on this thing. And there are some specific recommendations, for example. One, of course, I'm sure you've heard that there should be cuts to the tune of $30 million. And I guess the question there is that – this is the question I asked the mayor earlier. Is that too much? Would that jeopardize public safety, a cut that?
Well, I think that's just the thing. You know, this demand of cutting $30 million – when I first heard it, I thought to myself, where are we getting this number? Yeah. Where is this number coming from?
Right.
And I don't know the answer to that. And our staff is working diligently to figure out what that would do, right? And we're looking at options of moving money into a different department where there's more transparency and more, a little bit more control from the council on where that money goes.
But I guess the question is, would that even be on the table, a cut that deep?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. And look, here's the thing for me. We do need to do something bold. I believe that. I believe we are at a moment with an opportunity to make change. But I also believe that it would be irresponsible to have a knee-jerk reaction. Mm. We need to do this the right way. Because if we just have a knee-jerk reaction, then where do we end up in 5 years? Do we actually change something, or was it a quick reaction and a band-aid that doesn't stop the bleeding, right? Yes, I have an obligation. I want to make change. I want to do it in the right way so that it is everlasting, that these changes are significant and real and continue.
Here's a question I put to the mayor. I want to ask you the same one. Does Chief Brown have your support?
Yes, I think Chief Brown is trying to address the issues that we are all very concerned about.
Councilwoman, let me ask you this finally. So you have until about the end of the month to make a determination about the budget for the police department and other budgetary decisions, of course. But I'm obviously thinking about the police department. How is this moment going to alter that number? This was another question I asked the mayor. How are you going to, as a council, see to it that you take advantage of this particular moment? Because as you heard in that in those 10 hours of comment, people want something different to come out of this. They want something, some actual kind of change. At least that's that seemed to be the overwhelming sentiment expressed.
Right. Well, I think that we have to remember a couple of things. We have to remember that the city still has to continue, and we still have services that are provided by our police department and by all of our departments. And we have an obligation to ensure that those services continue to be provided at the highest level we can to all of our residents. Now, I still don't know what we're going to do. We have another council meeting to look at the options. One of the options is moving a significant amount out of the police department into somewhere else where we can really monitor where that money is going. While we have to have a budget by the end of the month, and that's state statute, mm-hmm. we may put things in kind of a holding account, if you will, so that throughout the year we can determine how and where that money should be spent. We do have options, but we also have to ensure that the city continues to run and continues to operate in the way that our residents expect it to.
Councilwoman Fowler, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Amy Fowler, she represents Salt Lake City's Council District 7. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is always at your side with level-headed breakdowns of fast-moving headlines. That's why we're right there on your smart speaker. Once you've set your alarms and made that online buy, wind down with NPR Utah by telling your smart speaker to play KUER. It's not two-day shipping. In fact, it's more than that. With immediate journalism you can trust day after day after day. Easy. Just tell your smart speaker to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the demands you're hearing from protesters around the country. They want something done this time about police violence targeted at people of color. Joining us now on the program is the chief of the Salt Lake City Police Department, Mike Brown. Chief Brown, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to ask first, you chose to kneel with protesters last week. And I wanted to ask why. And in particular, was it just an act of goodwill and good faith, or was it in some way some kind of official acknowledgement that there's systemic problems of violence in the police department against people of color?
Doug, when I chose to kneel, it was the right thing to do. We stand in solidarity with our community, and especially our communities of color, as we're in a very difficult time. Across the country, from what we saw that happened on May 25th, when Mr. Floyd, when his life was tragically and heinously taken, does not represent this police department. And the outcry and the change, everything that we're all trying to do is what we should be doing. And as a police chief, I wanted to show our community and stand with them, saying we've always been willing to sit down and talk. We've always been able to have those hard conversations, and we're willing to do it now. It wasn't a photo shoot. It was what I truly felt in my heart.
I've heard you say this, that we're you'd like to think we're a little better here in Salt Lake City. I want to know what you mean by that. Is Salt Lake City's police department an exception from what we're seeing around the country? You see the statistics. Black people are 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. 1 in 1,000 black men and boys in America can expect to die at the hands of police. How do you see Salt Lake City as somehow an exception to that larger story?
I know the women and men of this police department, Doug, and they're great individuals. And they work hard every day to serve this community. Sadly, I think policing, and I think this is the outcry we're hearing, there is systematic racism built into the processes and the things that we do. And I think it's almost subtle that we don't see it and we haven't recognized it. And I think it's now at a crescendo that we've got to do something about it. I mean, I've spoken for years about we'll never arrest our way out of addiction. We'll never arrest our way out of homelessness. We'll never arrest our way out of mental health issues. We're always called to deal with a lot of these social economic problems on the front end. And that's where I think we need to start having these conversations. We cannot be used that way anymore. And as a society, we need to look at a better way to do this. So when we talk about systematic racism or systematic problems within law enforcement, I think we need to look at, absolutely, we'll look at law enforcement and what we do. But I think the system is even bigger and the problem is even more enormous than we think.
It gets to the question of funding, and I'll get there in a moment. But let me ask you this. Do you need somewhere on the order of 560-plus police officers in Salt Lake City? Could there be fewer officers and more social workers, more people doing other things? Do you need that many officers to do the job that you're doing, or is this one of the things that you could consider? Because this is one of those suggestions, I'm sure you know, that people are talking about in terms of reforming the way police departments are managed and funded and staffed.
Yeah. Well, you know, Doug, right now, now is not a time for a knee-jerk reaction. Now is the time to listen and to learn and to bring all the parties to the table in order to ensure equity of change. I think we have to do this on evidence-based. I think it has to be informed. I think it has to be comprehensive, and it's got to be thoughtful. But I think right now is the time to act, to do something. There's a lot of studies that show that communities of color are disproportionate victims of serious violent crimes, and that cuts to any police budget will disproportionately harm those very communities. And so when you ask me specifically, do we need that many police officers? We've been working very hard over the last 4 years so that we could have enough officers to put an officer in every beat within this community. There are 24 beats. What our goal is to really build a community policing model where we are part of the community, that we stand with the community, that we have time to go do a pickup game with the youth or to sit down and talk with the store owner. But when we're cut to the point where we don't have enough staffing, all we do is go call to call to call. Or a lot of times calls stack. Sometimes the calls that we receive that are low priority today, we don't get to them until tomorrow. So I really feel that we need these officers, but I think we need to have a paradigm shift and start thinking about how they become part of the communities and how do we build those trust and those relationships, because that is where we're going to make real change in this country and here in Salt Lake City.
How much would you be willing to bear in the way of actual funding cuts? I'm sure you've heard the one number, and it just seems like to have come out of the air. I don't know where people are getting it, but $30 million has been suggested as a cut. And one of the things that we've talked about with the mayor, with Councilwoman Fowler and others is just the growth trajectory of your budget in the department. It's grown. It's grown more than the raise for the traditional raise of cost of living. And I'm wondering if you would be willing to bear or rethink some of those, some of the funding. And what would $30 million do to your department? I think that's something that really worries you.
Yeah. It does. I mean, if you really put pen to paper, $30 million is about 273 officers. Now, we have 569 officers here at the police department. About 60 or so are part of the airport, that's reimbursed to the city on an enterprise fund.
Yeah.
So if we have about 500 and you cut 273, you're down to 230. That barely gives us enough officers to fill the beats within our city. That doesn't give us any investigation. So I think that would be a tragic way to go forward. I think we really need to sit down and talk. And I've always been, the hardest part of any conversation is listening. But that's my commitment to the community, and that's my commitment to the city council, to the mayor. Let's have these conversations, and let's really talk about what it's going to do and what it's going to look like 6 months or a year down the road.
And you're willing to make substantial changes. It sounds like you're geared up for at least a conversation about reform efforts that are not drastic. Maybe that's not the right word, but different, significant.
Yeah, but big changes start with little incremental changes. And so, immediately, even though we don't allow chokeholds and we don't allow tear gas to be used on crowds, we immediately put out policies 2 days ago at 8:54 in the morning that basically said we banned those things. And those are the type of changes we can make, but we make those immediately. I'm more than willing to sit down with the community, with oversight commissions. We've worked very hard. We recently just completed a CLIA accreditation, which is kind of the gold standard in policing, where they look at policies, they review your policies, make sure that you're doing things to the best standard within the country. There are audits that they do. So we're trying to do that on our own, but it's never enough. We need to continue moving the needle. And that's my commitment, to work with the community and with the city council to better this police department.
Chief, let me ask you this finally. I know this has been a difficult week for you. You lost your father, former police officer, who I think you've talked about as being sort of a model for you, for an officer, a police officer who did the right thing. How are you contrasting that image of a good cop against this eruption that's happening of people asking really big questions about the value of policing and demanding these kinds of big changes?
Doug, I did. I lost my father last week. I'm sorry. My dad was a good, kind police officer. Before de-escalation was a thing, he de-escalated situations. He tried to resolve things at the lowest level. If he could resolve a situation with a handshake and a kind word, he did that. I think that's what he has instilled in me. He would be the officer that we need today. And through his mentoring and his leadership, I hope I am the officer that we need today. And I really feel like I am a change agent. I am somebody that can work hard with this community. And we in Salt Lake City can be a leader across the country as to how we do this work and how we change the systematic racism, how we work very hard to better serve our community and show the country that it can be done, and it can be done now.
Chief Brown, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Doug.
Mike Brown, he's the chief of the Salt Lake City Police Department. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER wants you to share your feedback about our statewide services. Do you have a question about a program you heard on KUER? How can we better serve the community that you live in? Consider taking a moment to fill out our online feedback form. You can also use this form to send a tip to the KUER newsroom. Write to the station with your feedback at kuer.org/feedback.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This week, we reached out to LaShawn Williams for some perspective. She's an assistant professor of social work at Utah Valley University. And Dr. Williams grew up in a military family. So the demand to defund the police and this criticism that these departments have become overly militarized complicates her reaction.
You know, when you grow up on military bases, you're used to seeing uniforms, you're used to seeing Humvees, you're used to seeing tanks. It's the fabric of my visual and my lived experience. So to start seeing police being militarized, it's a surreal kind of thing. When my parents retired from the military, we didn't live in areas or zones where we would have had consistent police presence. But for folks who do, it creates a sort of empathy with war zones and international areas. I think that I've become a lot more sensitized to the things that I take for granted or the way that my ears will perk up when I hear military helicopters. I know how they sound. And I love to see when the Blue Angels do a flyover. It's a very double consciousness kind of experience, to quote early Black scholars like W.E.B. Du Bois talking about Black double consciousness, being Black and being American and understanding that you're living kind of in two worlds. When you start talking and hearing about intersectionality, there's this intersectional consciousness that I now have as a Black person, as an American, as a military kid, as a woman, as a mother, et cetera, and so on and so forth.
When you see police officers throughout the country in riot gear, how do you think most people are responding to that? Do you know what I mean? Like, that, again, it goes to this, like, just the image of them in helmets and having these, you know, having the gear geared up as they are. What's the image that represents, do you think?
Every single photograph of officers in riot gear is immediately an us versus them. It's not a comforting feeling for me, just as it wouldn't be a comforting feeling to be on the receiving end of any sort of military presence. It's not comforting to me. It's a surreal, disorienting experience to see police officers in military grade gear.
When you hear people say defund the police or dismantle the police, do you think that they mean it?
I think we're looking for a silver bullet. Defund the police and then we can fix all of the problems. I don't necessarily know that we've had the discussion to follow it to its most logical conclusions within the context of our communities. I think it may feel good initially to say get rid of all of the police, but if that's a conversation you want to have, then we have to go back to the 60s. We have to go back to the Black Panther movement. We have to go back to the community policing that Black people were trying to do in California to protect Black communities from police brutality. So now if we're going to defund the police because they're being brutal to communities, absolutely, let's talk about that. Let's defund what funds the brutality. Yes. But let's also discuss the fact that when you have community patrols and Black people are trying to police and to control and to protect their own communities, we still can't be devoid of our contextual history that quote unquote slave patrols were the beginnings of our police forces.
Yeah. And it seems like you're concerned about the way we're having these conversations. So if you frame it as we're going to take, like in Salt Lake City, we're going to take $30 million from your budget, that comes across as just, I think, as you've put it, economic punishment. And it seems like what you're saying is this is not quite the way to handle this conversation.
It's not. And you have to understand, like, even in my own learning and growing experience as a person who wants to be a friend to many, traveling to Costa Rica in the last 2 years and understanding that they defunded and got rid of their entire military budget and put all of it into community programming, that's a beautiful thing to read. Those are wonderful words to read. The lived experiences of the people, they still found ways to police. they still found ways to have that physical intimidating presence. It just wasn't called the military. So I look at those experiences and I look at the economics of Costa Rica, the good and the struggle, and I wonder if that's what people think, that it's going, you know, it's not a Thanos snap.
Yeah.
You can't snap your fingers, defund the police. And our language, we're going to take from your budget and put it into something else because we believe that disarming you is the answer. We've had that same conversation around arming or disarming Black communities. We want to keep these communities disarmed. We have this conversation about folks feeling disarmed and taken from all of the time. This is not necessarily, I don't think it's the best narrative for us to continue having, is that we're going to take and disarm and defund you so that we can help them. It's this zero sum game. This is why we can't have talks about privilege, because folks are like, well, no, you're going to take from me and give it to somebody else. No, I'm trying to restructure how we do policing. Now, if we say, hey, we're going to look at $30 million in this budget that's allocated to you and see how can we restructure it to better create the community policing and the relationships that we really say we value as a community. That's a conversation that people are more invited to be in so they can invest in it. They can engage in it so they can be invested in it. They can have buy-in. If we keep having this thing about you're the enemy, you're the bad guy, you're the system that is compromised, which is true about our law enforcement systems. I do think that they are compromised and set up to fail based on how that they've been structured. But the way that we do it, it matters. And you need the engagement and the buy-in from the people who feel like they're going to lose out. If the only way that our officers feel like they're getting paid their worth is because they're a militarized organization, let's talk about why that is. If that's where they get the majority of their funding, how do we talk about that and say, listen, there's value even if you're not getting extra money from being funded as a paramilitary organization? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Why is it, Professor, that we're inclined to look for a common enemy?
We're seeking safety. That's it. And if you and I both agree that we feel safe together because that's the problem and that's the drama, then we can band together and fight that thing. We do have unified enemies, and we have unified enemies in the fact that we treat each other terribly. So we have to honestly look at, okay, what's it going to take for me to dig deep, even as the person who is attacked, even as the person who is unsafe? Is there a way to create safety where both of us can engage? Because this is about safety. This is about power differentials. If I feel like the other group has more power than I do, how do I trust that you're going to use your power to benefit my needs? It's not going to cost you a thing. I talk about privilege in this way. Privilege is not a use it or lose it. You have it whether you use it or not. Are you willing to leverage it for this conversation? Because it's still going to benefit you. But if we can't have that conversation, then we risk feeling like it's us versus them. And here's this common enemy, this invisible enemy, this enemy we can unite against. And then we honestly lose sight of each other's humanity. And that's hard to say, hey, care about this person's humanity, even if this is the person that's hurting you. That's really difficult. But again, you're talking to someone who's a professor, but I'm also a clinician. And I understand that this is trauma work. We are a deeply traumatized society, a deeply traumatized people. And we have really got to do that deep trauma-informed work as a new perspective to help us adjust as a community together over time. There's not going to be one. It's not like you go to the chiropractor, you get adjusted, and it's like, oh, that's great. It fixed everything. You keep going back to the chiropractor to get adjusted because you know your spine is likely and prone to go out of whack. Our spine is out of whack as a country. So we need to figure out what our ongoing adjustments are going to be. And there's no room, there's no healthy room for enemies within that adjustment discussion.
So you're saying that outrage, that can be helpful, but so can empathy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When we're talking about enemies, we're talking about dissonance and difference and division and space. What we really want to start looking at and looking for and creating is resonance. How do we resonate with each other? I can't do it if I'm seeing you as my enemy. That's dissonance. I need resonance. So the thing about resonance is that it is going to be uncomfortable to get there, uncomfortable to sit there, uncomfortable to stay there. But if we are really seeking to resonate with each other, then you're going to say, you know what? Okay, this $30 million is going to hurt. but what is that conversation? Walk me all the way through it so I can understand, and let me go do the work to sit in this dissonance about being taken from, so I can get to this resonance of being co-creator of success and of peace and of justice. And whatever word makes you feel good, resonate as a co-creator for that word.
Speaking of feeling uncomfortable, how many white people have you heard from over the last week asking you for advice or guidance, or like, LaShawn, I'm so sorry. What am I supposed to do? What should I read?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, what do you make of that?
It's an anxiety response. You know, in this work, ever since Trayvon Martin was murdered in 2012 and the Black Lives Matter movement started, in Black communities, especially those of us that descended here from the U.S. and the civil rights movement and chattel enslavement, we immediately thought of Emmett Till.
Yeah.
These conversations aren't new for us. And, you know, I think what's been important for me to recognize in my own community is we have to keep reliving this stress and this trauma. We don't get a break. Folks want to say it's post-traumatic stress syndrome. We're not at the post part yet. We're in the traumatic stress syndrome part. And my white friends who get it, but they get to move in and out of it.
Yeah.
So when they move in it and they're asking for more from their Black friends, whether it's me or other Black friends, I don't know that they realize that they're asking from people who, one, we just don't get a chance to be depleted. We don't get a chance to just sit and mourn and grieve, because immediately when trauma happens, we are expected to get to work, and the work happens on all levels. I've had some great conversations with some of my white friends. I've had white friends that have said to me, you know, I get it. I feel like I get it this time. I'm still uncomfortable with this. Can you talk to me about this? And I talked to my friend. I said, you know, it's really important for you to note in your own work that you knew that if you asked a white person, they would tell you, no, you're not a racist for thinking that. And they would console you and you would be fine, but you would know you're not doing the work. Or you could put it on social media and you know that that would bring out all kinds of emotions. But you came to me as a Black person because we have a friendship and we have a relationship that, you know, if I'm going to hold you accountable to something and say, yeah, that's a pretty racist thing to say, can you help me understand what your thinking is behind it? I'm still going to look for you. I'm not going to dismiss you as a racist that I can no longer be friends with. But people are at that point. They're dismissing and they're ending relationships because they're tired of being asked what I can do. What can you do? It's the same thing I told you to do last year when this happened. The same thing I told you to do last month when this happened, last week. Why do you keep needing to be told what to do? And it's an anxiety response from so many of our white friends. It's like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, I have to do it. I don't know how. I'm scared to start. And then I can just check out. I don't want to do politics. I just want to do, you know, memes of cats and babies. When you have the opportunity to do that, think about so many of us who wish we could have that opportunity too.
So when you say to them, do the same thing I told you last year or the year before, the same thing, what makes you think there is something different about this moment? And do you think there is going to be something different about this moment?
You know what? Let me be transparent and explain and share the numbness that I have to constantly manage about this moment. People are saying, I think this one is different, and all I can do is wonder why and what that will look like. I'm waiting for this window of opportunity to close, as it always does. I'm waiting for something else to happen. If it can be different, I know that countries have risen up and have said Black Lives Matter. And I've had this conversation within my friend group. And I said, you know, when Paris is attacked, or when any international city is attacked by some form of terrorism, we all are strong for that country. We all stand united. Do you think that's what people are really doing for Black Americans, for Black people in the US? And I looked at the protests that were happening in the United Kingdom, in England, and they were saying Black Lives Matter. They were talking about Stephen Lawrence, which is one of their own cases in London from the 1990s. And I say, you know, Black Lives Matter, this is Black Lives worldwide. This is not only people showing up for Black people in the U.S., it's them showing up for their own stories of anti-Blackness, their own histories of anti-Blackness in their countries. And so it's not just a movement here in the U.S. So if it's going to be different, the potential is for the whole world to be different. And that is such a big order to fill, such a big order to fill.
It's a small window. Probably starting to close. So you must have a sense of urgency, like we got to get to this.
Not at all. Not at all. This is slow and steady work. Hmm. This is marathon training. I anticipate the window to close, so I'm not worried about it. I don't have a sense of urgency. I have a sense of commitment that just gets deeper and deeper. I have really amazing friends who are willing to do this work, and I'm willing to structure the work so that we can honestly do it together, because this isn't going to be the last time. It's going to happen again. And I want people who want to do work to start getting ready now on themselves so they can get into their communities and their homes and their families and do this work. And it's unfortunate that we lose so many lights in this world, so many lights in the Black community, so many lights in Black communities across the world. We lose them to all sorts of different types of violence. But, you know, that gets overwhelming to think about healing the world from anti-Blackness. It's a goal, but it's, you know, overwhelming. So we think about healing the U.S. from our original sin of anti-Blackness and white supremacy. That's deep work. There's no sense of urgency, no sense of urgency more than June 1620, when the first enslaved Africans were brought to the shores of Jamestown, Virginia. This has been our work. And if it's urgent then, 400 years ago, it's still urgent today. So we have to really dig in deep, anchor ourselves, and start moving.
Professor LaShawn Williams, thank you very much.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
LaShawn Williams, she's an assistant professor of social work at Utah Valley University. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.